Good evening, ladies and gentlefers. Welcome to the South Africa podcast. You're listening to myself, Ivic Wolf, here with my co-host, Scratch.
Yo.
This evening, we have the wonderful privilege of having Ms.
Ms. is fine.
Tracy Butler, the creator of the Eisner-nominated web and print comic Lackadaisy. And yeah, so I mean, it's very, very good to have you on.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, the pleasure's all ours, I think. So maybe just tell us a little bit about like what the sort of draw towards something like Lackadaisy was all the way back when you started in, what was it, 2006?
Yeah. Well, I'd been working in the game industry for a long time at that point, and I'd kind of transitioned into being a art director, manager type of job at that point. And I was really kind of feeling the need to do more hands-on work. I like to actually be doing the art and not delegating work to other artists or, you know, reviewing portfolios and hiring people and, you know, doing project planning and things like that. So I kind of needed an outlet for the creative stuff. And so in the late night hours after work, I would just come home and start drawing. And it kind of just, I had all these, I had recently bought an old house in an old neighborhood, and I got very interested in the history of the place and the city, and discovered there were these limestone caves underneath the city everywhere. I'd been living here a long time and somehow just didn't know that particular fact. And there were all these like folklore tales about bootleggers and things using it to hide liquor and move it around, traffic it around. And I was listening to like jazz and jazz revival at the time, and all these things just kind of culminated into a idea. And so I just took it and ran with it. It kind of just took over my brain like a weird parasite. And I initially thought, oh, I'll just, you know, kind of do it casually on the side. But anybody who does web comics for any period of time can tell you there's no such thing as doing it casually. It's all consuming work. So it kind of took over and became a labor of love, and so I've been doing it for many years now. And finally, in late 2015, I was able to kind of make the leap from doing it, you know, on a moonlighting basis to doing it full time. And so here I am.
So I mean, let's obviously with the term Lackadaisy, obviously, you know, lackadaisical and things like that. But I mean, like, where exactly, or how did you come up with the title, for starters? I've always been interested, and I've always wanted to ask that
kind
question.
Kind of a mixture of things. I like weird words, and I kind of like to collect obscure words and things. And I like to title all of the comic pages after, you know, with funny words that are kind of like apropos to the time period. Lackadaisy just, I don't know, it had a sort of rhythm to it that I found kind of like silly, but at the same time the word connotes some sort of like longing for the past, some kind of languidness. And a lot of the story is about characters who are very much living in the past and can't get beyond that. And so it just seemed like a great name for a speakeasy, and at the same time something that has a little bit of an emotional and silly character to it. And that seemed to basically sum up what the character of the comic was too. So I guess those things matched up in my head somehow.
So, I mean, and obviously a couple of these questions are gonna be based around, you know, the characters themselves. When you were thinking about this idea of, well, rum running cats, what exactly was the draw behind that? What exactly, or why cats, for starters?
That's the why cats question. that one's kind of multiform too in its answer. There's really no good or logical answer I can give. It just seemed like I think I was struck by the idea that these gangsters of old could be so charismatic and popular while at the same time being such villains. And I don't know, cats in mythology always seem to be cast as the villain, but they have this sort of charisma that you know, the look on their face that makes them so forgivable at the same time. So I guess I kind of like drew some lines in my head between cats and gangsters, and you know, thought, well, they're kind of nature's gangsters, right?
So seems like they're always up to something.
Yeah, I mean, if they had thumbs, they'd probably be bootlegging stuff, right? So have some kind of underground organization of some sort. And so, yeah, I mean, and then, I don't know, there's all these, you know, puns about fat cats and alley cats and things like that, that jazz cats.
Yeah.
And so it just seemed to, I don't know, the idea clicked. I can't tell you exactly what my mindset was at the time. I was very much... Whenever any artist is starting a new project, you're so in love with it. Sometimes you aren't thinking clearly, rationally. And you're kind of like chemically insane in the same way you are when you're, you know, first falling in love with a person. And and so not all of the decisions necessarily make sense, and you kind of have to justify them further down the road. But yeah, it seems to, I don't know, it feels natural to me at this point, and hopefully it's not too... people do ask the question a lot, like, why cats? But hopefully it feels like a natural decision to have made.
And also, there's something inherently not liberating. It's just, I feel like the further away you step from realism, more onto the, like, representational art spectrum, the more you can accentuate different things, like different elements of each character, and along with that, the whole thing about using anthropomorphic characters, it just lends itself a lot more to characterization than anything else.
Certainly, yeah. I feel like if I was drawing human characters and putting them through a lot of these scenarios and having them make these really extreme facial expressions and things that they do, it'd be almost off-putting. I think it's much more palatable when it's a cuter character doing it. And I think that also helps people maybe understand that the story isn't meant to be taken too seriously, even though it covers some dark material at points. It's not, it has a certain levity, I think, or lends it a certain levity that is necessary. I feel like with a prior project I was working on, I let it get too self-serious. And I was, I don't know, had a certain amount of self-reproach over that in retrospect as I, you know, look back on it and go, what did I do wrong here? And that project didn't really ever get off the ground. And I, even though I'd worked on it for a long time, it was kind of like stuck in forever in development. And so I decided with this project, it's got to have a different sort of spirit to it. And it can't take itself too seriously, just because of the material and such. So yeah, I took it in that direction with the anthropomorphic animals. I think the large eyes and tails and ears helped me make them even more expressive than they could be if they were cartoon humans, for example. So so it gives me some extra appendages to play around with there.
So I mean, with 12 years of sort of working on this comic, and I mean, I've actually just looked all the way back to 2006 to, you know, the most recent comic that you had. There is an amount of consistency that I'm assuming a large amount of people are envious of. How exactly do you maintain that? Like, what exactly did you? Yeah.
I'm not sure I was entirely successful with maintaining consistency. I mean, I hopefully the characters are all very recognizable still. But I did, there certainly was some artistic drift along the way. I think as it started to feel more natural to draw the characters. And in some ways, they probably became a little bit more generic looking as they went, which is regrettable. But it's just kind of the natural. Anytime you're working on something over a number of years like this, you've got to kind of let it evolve a little bit. I think I would have driven myself nuts if I had been, you know, pointedly trying to or putting a concerted effort into keeping it looking the same way it always looked. So you may have noticed it has kind of gradually gone from being a sepia tone escapade to being something that's closer to, it's not quite full color at this point, but it's closer to that. Although that was not my plan to begin with, I kind of, don't know, maybe there's something to be said for letting it drift from something that looked like an old photo into something that looks more happening here and now, I suppose. Mm. Maybe that lends a little bit of visual interest. People seem to like the color a lot more. I think the sepia does get pretty monotonous and is limiting in some ways. So much of the comic takes place at night, and the sepia colors, you end up with these muddy brown colors, and mm-hmm. It just isn't all that appealing looking in practice. So I kind of reserve that now for art that I do off on the side, where I'm drawing characters in a kind of like faked old photo, vintage photo look. But but yeah, the art has there's some amount of consistency in that the characters retain their, you know, their looks more or less. Hopefully, hopefully they're all still quite, you know, identifiable. But yeah, the art itself has become a more complex array of things, with a lot more atmospheric effects and things like that mixed in, texture and such that didn't really exist before.
Mm. Now, obviously, your blurb that you sort of furnished towards us, what exactly is a clouder?
A clouder is the term for any collection of felines, like you would have a murder of crows or,
yeah.
A parliament of owls.
Herd of sheep. Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. So cats, it's a clouder of cats.
Hmm. I've actually never heard that collective.
Really? Oh, okay.
Before. Never, no. Huh. Okay. So, I mean, obviously there are sort of like notes, in essence, of, I guess, sort of film noir at times in respect to the way that you've like placed your characters up, your femme fatale, your all of the characters that you have. Like, how did you build them? What exactly was the sort of like idea behind every, like, not every character, but obviously like all of your main characters? Why exactly were they the ones that sort of like spoke to you?
Character development is kind of a, I can't say that I sat down and like deliberately outlined every aspect of every character. It just doesn't really tend to work that way. You kind of start out with a concept that's kind of one dimensional maybe. And then you kind of gradually, as you start sketching the character out and getting to know them, figuring out what kind of clothes they wear, and then you start thinking about like, where did they come from, what things are they hung up on, what are their motivations, and all of these things start kind of culminating into a more kind of snowballs into a more a clearer picture. And so so they become very, they start out very generic and very flat, I would say, and then they kind of you kind of just like give them a bit of a push and roll them. They start rolling down the hill and gathering like moss and dirt and sticks and things. And at the end, they're like a collection of things that are much more dimensional and much more specific mm-hmm. To the story and to the whole idea. And so, yeah, they take on a bit of a life of their own, really. And I try to, I prefer, my personal preference when it comes to storytelling is for things that are character-driven as opposed to plot-driven, where characters kind of like fill in the necessary roles to move the plot from point A to point B. I like things where the characters are at the wheel. It tends to make things a bit more interesting and a bit maybe more relatable because because that's how life is, right? It's there's no pre-existing story that we all fit into like little, you know, chess pieces. It's more of a the characters decide what happens, and kind of just letting it work out that way has been has made the whole thing a lot more fun for me to work on, I think. So yeah, and then as to the noir stuff, it's the 1920s was kind of a, I guess you could say there were some like proto film noir films at that time. Mm-hmm. Noir didn't really emerge as a distinct film style until probably the late 30s and early 40s, but definitely there are elements of that mixed in there.
I mean, it all sort of goes with the color palette that you do choose as well. It's the reason why I sort of bring up film noir in the way that I do, because large amount of the sort of film noirs are these sort of, anti-heroes attempting to do what they need to do to sort of survive. And it seems like every, yeah.
Characters who have a certain amount of cynicism and they're kind of fallen into a some kind of murky underworld of some sort where they don't quite understand what's going on, and the certainty of their survival is not there. So yeah, it's and then of course the art style, the monochrome that it started out with was certainly film noir. We obviously, not every noir film is black and white, but it's certainly something we associate with that. So yeah, certainly some correlations there.
And I mean, what was it? Like, I mean, obviously it's the prohibition, with that entire idea. Like, I mean, it's definitely a very interesting part of American history.
Yeah, a little bit
And
bonkers, really.
yeah, very,
That
very.
ever happened is almost inconceivable, but it did, and we're left with a particularly interesting decade there where things got a little nuts. But there was like all this societal hedonism at the time, but at the same time, it was so puritanical in some ways, like the no drinking and everything that had been brought on by the temperance movement. And but at the same time, all this underground world of extreme lasciviousness and just debauchery and fun was thriving as a result. So just a really interesting mix of things.
I
It
mean,
was such a if you read any history about the Victorian era and the Edwardian era that preceded it, it's almost amazing how progressive and different the 20s were. It was just like people just they were so tired of corsets and propriety and everything that it just all went out the window almost all at once in the 1920s.
Yeah, it's the what's it? That was sort of the advent of realism in writing as well, in the way that yeah, like what was it? People like Charlotte Bronte sort of moved towards that sort of era, and then directly after that, with the death in essence of the Victorian era and the I think it was the Edwardian era, then came this sort of like almost. And it's weird, like we talk about generations and the way that they continually move from one point to the next point, but it's actually quite sort of interesting how elements from previous generations continually find their way into
Yeah,
what
it
we're
seems very,
doing.
it kind of gets, there's a cyclical aspect to it. You see it not only in like writing themes and things, but also even in like fashion and art styles. Just studying the 1920s and what clothes looked like at that time, you kind of like see how it reappeared again in like a different iteration in like the 1960s. And how like the 1940s clothing styles reappeared again in the 1980s in large part. It's interesting stuff that you start noticing when you start doing research for a project like this. It's illuminating. So I think, yeah, I've learned a lot doing this comic that about subjects that I wouldn't have even known I had any interest in. I mean, my interest comes secondary to interest in the comic, but then you just all of these things start becoming so like you make these connections between the past and the present, and it's really quite fascinating. Historical fiction was never something I thought I would have been doing, but here I am, and it's been an enriching experience.
All right. We have a question from the audience here. Tracy Trace asks, yeah, weirdly enough, Trace and Kit, they're sort of listening together. How do you feel about us coming into a new 20s era?
Interesting question. I feel like while I don't want to relitigate the 20th century, it feels almost like that's where we're heading from a socio-political standpoint, regrettably, but a little bit worried about the liberal democratic world order at this point following that G7 summit, but I have concerns. I do hope we don't, but America is I don't know that I should steer the topic towards political, but we have a administration that right now that is trying to do what basically bring America back to what it was before the world wars happened, which was fairly isolationist. That is how the wars tend to happen, is these divisions between these, you know, trade disagreements and things like that, and economic situations that arise when you don't have something like NATO and NAFTA and things to kind of keep the peace. So that's a little worrying. But then at the same time comes this like very tenuous economic growth, which we're also seeing right now in the country, and it's all predicated on bad business. And so, yeah. I kind of foresee, a lot of economists foresee a crash in the future, which of course was looming overhead in the 20s as well. And so politically, yeah, it's almost like we're back where we started from in some ways. And that's concerning, because as much as I love reading about the 20s and you know, early 20th century history, I don't really want to relive it. I don't think that's good for the world at large. But but I mean, in terms of the comic, yeah, I don't know. I've seen a pretty big resurgence in 1920, an interest in 1920s in popular media in recent years. And I wonder if that's maybe because we're coming up on 100-year anniversary. Things like Boardwalk Empire was very big on HBO, and then Peaky Blinders and Miss Fisher's Mysteries, and lots of things kind of popping up now. The kind of like gangster film thing has been out of style for such a long time. I kind of wonder if maybe that we'll see some new material in that realm, just because 100 years is, I mean, a centennial is kind of a a big deal, and maybe people's minds will be on that, and will be very retrospective about what the 1920s was like, and how it relates to where we are now.
Yeah.
Anything with when it comes to history and entertainment always seems to be so it's very introspective in that way. It's not just a time machine and going and looking at something that happened before. It's always in how does it relate to what we're experiencing right now, and it does in a lot of ways, as far as I can tell. So
yeah.
Okay. Interesting times. We live in interesting times, for better or worse.
No, absolutely true.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it, sort of a lens on current affairs, with the idea of those that do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it, that kind of thing.
It's almost like maybe a cry a little bit to pay attention to what's happening now and how you can relate it to what happened then and what we can learn from it. It's almost like artists tend to collectively cry out, look what happened. Don't do it again.
The empire is falling.
Right. I'll be running around in the street with our arms flailing right now. But
yeah. But I mean, and obviously we just perspective, obviously you were, as you said in your comic here or in your blurb, you mentioned the idea of being Eisner nominated for Women Print Comic. What exactly is the Eisner? This is the first time that I've actually heard of the Eisner.
Basically, I guess you would say it's the Oscars of the comic world. I certainly didn't expect to be nominated for anything, but I think the digital comic category that it was nominated in is so new. Maybe some of the nominations do come out of left field, but yeah, it's was quite an honor and unexpected one. I really hadn't done any serious comic work before starting on Lackadaisy, and so that was validating and meant a lot to me. I don't really know a whole lot of people in the comics world. I was still working in the game industry at the time, and so that was where all my contacts were and such. So yeah, that's what that is. That's generally, I think, do they announce at, I think San Diego Comic-Con is usually where they do the award announcements. But yeah, I mean, if you pay any attention in the comic world, that's the big award. There's, of course, there's other ones like the Hugo Awards and stuff like that, where there's a category for comic material and things and that are, you know, also very prestigious. That but I've never really been terribly active in seeking those things out. I think as a digital, as a comic that's native to the internet, I didn't really consider Lackadaisy in that same category as like print comics. And even though it does appear in book form, it's, you know, that came subsequent to being a web comic. And so it was kind of nice to see that it maybe fit a little bit into both of those places. So
Hello?
Yeah, we can
hear
you.
I'm still
we
can hear me?
Okay. Shit.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Obviously you've also been nominated quite often for the Ursa Majors.
Oh yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And yeah, it's I've been trying to find out the last couple of years. The thing is I don't know, like how do you feel about the Ursa Majors?
I think it's great that it's a thing. I have a little bit of an issue with awards in general, where there's a bit of a game you have to play, where you have to kind of go and unless you're an extremely popular, like bestseller sort of thing, and you're already an established artist or writer in the comics industry, you have to go kind of solicit votes. You have to kind of like put it out there and say, hey, I've been nominated for this, would you come vote for me, or incentivize it in some way. And I don't like playing that particular game. I mean, even with behind the scenes with stuff like the Oscars, there's apparently these campaigns that these films and actors will run to try to send gifts out and things like, please consider voting for, you know, and I just, that just seems contrary to what the point is. It's, you know, it's more of a, it becomes more of a popularity contest in that way, or, you know, a advertising contest than something that's based on the merit of the work. And so I don't particularly want to engage in that, as much as it would be great to win an award. If I win an award, I want it to be because the work is good and it speaks for itself, and not because I was out there on social media going, hey guys, vote for me, and you know, annoying my follower base and then things with that sort of you know, with pandering and pleading with them. And it's just kind of, I don't know, because you do get there's an incentive to do that, because you get the fanfare and the news articles and the notoriety from having won an award, and so from a business standpoint, it is a practical thing to do. But I just can't. I've never been very good at the self-promotion game aspect of this whole thing, and there are people who do it really well and who I admire for having the skills to do it. I just, it's not a skill set that I ever developed or felt comfortable with.
As much as we'd love them for a meritocracy to work out, like in this day and age, you have to lobby for something.
Right.
If you wanted to push it.
As appealing as meritocracy sounds, I think it's mostly fiction.
That and technocracy.
In function. You maybe get a little bit of meritocracy plus, like exclusive club sort of, you know, favoritism and things like that. It's maybe a mingling of those two things, but I don't think you ever get like, you know, pure unadulterated merit based anything really.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the literary awards that we have as well, that one actually does sort of look more on what do you call it?
Like the Pulitzer.
Like other, no man. I'm the furry one from the Writers Guild.
Oh, the Coyote Awards.
Yeah, that one doesn't necessarily work too much on meritocracy, or at least on a voter basis, on a voter roll. It's actually the, what's it? It's much like the Oscars in some senses, in that there's a group of people who get together and sort of like run down the votes and see who goes where and how they get there.
But yeah, since it is contained within the Furry Writers Guild, it obviously merit weighs more than, you know, pats on the back and fruit baskets.
In any kind of like smaller maybe more niche group like that, you get a bit more of that like honest to goodness, you know, this is a good thing, and that's why we gave it an award. And anything that goes more mainstream and just becomes a bigger, I think that invites more of that maybe less honest assessment into the picture.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons I very much appreciate the furry community, is because it is like the small self-governed, self-made fandom.
Oh, God.
That does cherish independent creation and independent creators and, you know, artists who set out doing their own thing, to do their own thing. And that's been kind of the thing that has made all the difference for me in terms of going to conventions. I used to go to lots of comic conventions, and they, you have, you know, then I started doing, like I went to Anthrocon, I got invited to be a guest there, and it was just a totally different atmosphere, totally different culture, and so much more inviting and friendly that it made me realize how masochistic it is to go to comic conventions, like major comic conventions, and put up with the, you know, the sneering from people who come by the table and they are annoyed with you for not having more free stuff to give away, or, you know, free swag and things like that. It's like, well, I'm just a small operation. I can't make enamel pins and give them away for free. I'd you know, break the bank to do that. Whereas something, you know, large company can afford that. And they're there promoting their, you know, best-selling, you know, comics and their movies and television shows. And they kind of like shuffle off the small press people into a corner or into the basement or something. And so, but the furry conventions are a much, much different affair, and a very welcome change of pace. Kind of a tangent there, but
no, definitely worth listening and hearing.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is actually another question here, once again, from Trace and Kit. They ask, how have you felt about the interest in your comic now from, obviously, the furry fandom back in 2006? I'm obviously asking, like, did you know about the fandom before you sort of started this entire thing, or...
Oh, yeah, I knew about it. I was drawing things that I guess you... I didn't know what furries were, or I didn't know there was, like, an anthropomorphic art community when I, you know, first showed up on the internet in the late 90s, and I just started posting my work, and I put up a webpage and discovered YERF. And so I actually had art there once upon a time, way back, when that was, I think there's still an archive version of it. You can probably find some of my really old stuff there. But I didn't know what I was producing something that already had, like, a community built around it. And so I kind of stumbled into it that way. And while I didn't really consider myself a furry, I was, obviously my work was very furry adjacent, and I had a lot of people who were watching my art who were, and they've always been the, like, consistently the most supportive group of people in terms of, you know, they, where other people will kind of grouse at having to spend money or something on something you've made, or commissioning you, and you're, you know, if you've got prices out there, and they'll complain at you, whereas, like, the furry community is like, here, take my money, and, you know, you're not charging enough, I'm paying you more. And that was, like, bewildering, but excellent. So so I've always been very grateful to this, like, kind of community of people who are supportive of independent artists, and you know, they know what they like, and they seek it out, and they look to support those people who are producing things that they enjoy. And it's just kind of a more personal, more intimate relationship that you can have with your readership and audience when that sort of thing is there. They're like, they actively want you to succeed, and you feel welcome, so it's always been kind of a thing that's been there. I didn't like tailor Lackadaisy to that or anything. I think probably what would have been a more popular choice in the furry community was to do an assortment of animals, not just cats. But I've always been cognizant of that factor in my, if you can call it success, because I'm doing the comic full time now, then it's always been a factor, and I have been aware of that. So I certainly have a lot of gratitude for that.
Okay.
Did I answer your question? I don't even know.
I think you did.
How do I feel? Oh, yeah. I guess that was that more or less covered it.
No, for sure.
That was very, very good. So, I mean, take us through the process of creating just one page.
I was
because...
about to ask that.
So I get asked a lot, like, have you planned the story out in full? The answer to that is yes and no. I have basically a skeleton outline that I work from, and the closer I am to actually doing art for something, the more fleshed out it is in my notes and such, the more dialogue writing and stuff I've done, and development as to, you know, what this place looks like, this where the scene happens, like, you know, what is there, what's going on. And as I move along, you know, the backbone of that outline toward where I'm heading, I do, you know, switch scenes around the order of things that happen. I change, the dialogue is constantly in flux. I usually am editing that right up until I post a page. I have some, you know, and I insert jokes and references to things and stuff that I happen to have been reading about at the time or whatever I happen to have taken an interest in at the time. And so that kind of keeps my interest in it, but at the same time, it gives me some direction to head in. Anyway, as I approach a page, I tend to thumbnail out a full chapter at a time. So it's usually a collection of anywhere from, you know, 4 to 10 pages that I do thumbnails for at any given moment. And then working from that, I do, once I'm sort of happy with where I am there, I start doing my penciling. I still draw everything on paper with a pencil, Bristol paper, even though so much of the process is digital. I think sometimes people are surprised to hear that it's still kind of a pencil and paper thing behind all the bells and whistles.
Yeah.
And then I scan all that stuff in, and I relay it out digitally. So I end up basically with a very rough looking pencil version of the page that I would basically never show to anybody because it's very ugly at this point. And then I'll, like, you know, I'll rough in things that I, changes that I need to make with digital blobs of color and stuff like that, and, you know, arrows drawn everywhere, and kind of just work on the layout, and it tends to change a bit from what the thumbnails look like at that point in the, you know, layout process, because once you actually have the full thing in front of you at a, you know, something relative to full size, you kind of see, like, what flows, what works and doesn't, where do I maybe need an extra panel here to communicate something, is this other panel maybe extraneous and I can just cut it out altogether. And so that, you know, that's just another part of the editing phase. And then I clean up all of that line work, and I start adding my values. So I work in grayscale at that point, adding all the shadow and light, atmospheric stuff and things. And then I do another pass of cleaning all that up, sharpening my lines up where I've lost all of my pencil work. I have to kind of rework the lines a bit and add some textures in, add color layers and overlay layers and such to add a little bit more than just the sepia tone to it, and put the speech bubbles where they belong based on my ever-changing dialogue for a given page. And for each page that's, I mean, my pages are usually, when I say page, I'm talking about the what I actually upload at one time to the internet, which is usually when I relay it out and, you know, for book printing, anywhere from 2 to 4 pages. So it's a page, but it's more like a snippet of story that's, you know, generally more than a single page of comic. Just because I take so long, I figure, you know, I might as well put as much out there as I can at a given moment. Yeah. It's kind of encapsulate a singular, whatever kind of, like, forms a complete thought in terms of storytelling. Mm. And so those tend to take me probably, how many hours is hard to say, but it's usually about 3 weeks of pretty intense work to produce one of those. And then I kind of spend whatever time left I have during a month doing, you know, Patreon obligations, doing live streams and custom patron drawings and whatever little freelance things I've taken on the side, I tend to squeeze those in in whatever time left I have. So, yeah, it's pretty intense. Many, many hours per page. I've learned to enjoy the process, and there's a lot of spaces in there where it's just hours and hours of having my face kind of pressed up against a Cintiq or you know, piece of paper, and I use those moments to listen to podcasts and kind of educate myself about the era or just related things that are, you know, interest to me, or
put on some, or to listen to music,
just kind of
put on some 99% Invisible or Love and Radio or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of I like things like Sawbones, which is like medical history and things of that nature. Yeah, it's
I'm looking for good podcasts, so anything, like any words that pop up, are like, I'm just trying to devour them as much as I can.
I listen to unrelated things too, like guilty pleasures, like My Favorite Murder, and things like that.
It's good to see. I'm not the only person who puts on like the Crime and Investigation Channel in the background when they're making food, kind of thing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I think the closest to that I get is creepypastas when I'm trying to go to sleep.
That's cool. Yeah. Why do you do that to yourself?
No, I don't actually. It's not even scary anymore. It's just like a lot of the time the person's voice is just monotone enough for me to drift away.
A little hypnotic, yeah. I suppose. Any of those Let's Read things or on YouTube or what have you. Yeah, I've fallen asleep to those things more than once. Yeah.
I used to fall asleep to Barney Simon for some reason.
Oh, but it must have been metal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was I gonna say now? Like you mentioned, like working on like pencil and paper to start off with. There's a certain warmth to pencil and paper that you don't get like drawing or sketching out on a Cintiq or something like that.
When I used to sketch,
I loved working pencil and paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it still feels like the most natural thing to me, and I still feel like I produce better drawings when I'm just doing pencil and paper and scanning it than when I work directly on like a Cintiq or something. When I was first, I first started working with Photoshop way, way back, probably the year 2000 or so. I had nothing but a mouse to work with, which was really I can't even conceive of doing something like this comic with that limitation. There's no pressure sensitivity. It's like drawing with a shoe. It just, you know.
I tried something like that as well, like inking a comic that you scanned with a mouse. It's no.
It'd take a special kind of person to put that much effort into mouse drawing, but
special kind of desperation.
People have done it before. People have done it, I mean, people have produced amazing things with Etch-a-Sketch. So you know, anything people can. Yeah. But I was not that person who was going to make a comic with a mouse and an MS Paint or whatever. But I got my first tablet probably early 2000s, like an Intuos tablet, and that was still a disconnect between. For some reason, painting seemed like a more natural thing, but the precision that is required with line work and like the interplay of your hand and the paper and the pencil is just so relaxing and so natural and. Just a whole different world of whole world apart from doing things digitally. The tablet was still, you know.
Yeah, sorry.
Much of an improvement. Sorry, go ahead.
The whole disconnect between having to, if you don't have like one of the Cintiq, the ones with the screen on it, not looking where you're drawing is incredibly disorienting at first.
Right. That took getting used to, and I did get used to it. I did that for a long, long time. When I first started Lackadaisy, for many years I was still just using a old Intuos 1 tablet. So there was a big disconnect between. And then as I got better technology, I started doing more of the work digitally. So you can see the comic, if you look back, you can see it's almost all pencil that's just toned in sepia. And then it gradually becomes more and more, like you can see more and more digital work on top of all of that as the comic goes on and on. And that's because I kept getting new tools that allowed me to do more of the work digitally more comfortably. So now I work on a Cintiq and I'm actually looking at maybe switching over to a mobile studio, which is another Wacom product. At some point here, because I've scuffed up my Cintiq pretty badly. The surface is worn. I'm gonna wear a hole in it eventually, but time to upgrade, I think.
Not looking at a Microsoft Surface or something like that?
No, the I've heard good things about them, but I think the pen technology is still not quite a competitor for Wacom. Mm-hmm. From what I've gathered, I've watched so many reviews on YouTube the past month or so of these products, mm-hmm. trying to figure out what I'm going to do moving ahead with, you know, some new equipment. And it seems like and I was planning to just upgrade to a new Cintiq, like the Cintiq Pros, but they got rid of the express keys on the tablet, and so you have to buy a separate like tool that has express keys on it that sits on, that you can like put off to the side or whatever, but it doesn't, like the bezel of the tablet isn't even wide enough that you can just put it there and not have it interfere with your workspace.
Oh,
I'm like, that's just, and then they've also started making tablets that are like USB-C instead of USB, you know, 2 or 3. Mm-hmm. And so that makes it a problem, because no one at this point, almost no one has a computer that supports USB-C.
Yeah.
Unless it's brand new. If you're working with a machine that's, you know, 2 years old or whatever, like most of us are, there's no way you can connect it. You have to get an adapter. And in order to hook it up with the adapter, you can't get the full 4K resolution, and you have to have cables plugged in on both sides of the tablet, which makes it much less portable than the current, than the old like 13 HD and such were. So it's, yeah, I'm talking about technology specs, which is probably boring territory for anybody who doesn't use this stuff, but
I think that it'd be very interesting for any budding artists out there to be able to hear that kind of, like, you know, information.
Yeah,
you know, helps them, so perfectly fine. Good topic.
Yeah, I'm sitting here staring at like a bamboo, like an Wacom bamboo still. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my Intuos 1 still works amazingly.
It's something.
Yeah.
I have a question with regards to sort of the the layout of your comic. I know a lot of people. Sort of, are you a proponent of sticking to square panels, or do you like sort of break out of the panels every now and then? Because I know some people take some artistic liberties and like use like essentially negative space between panels as the sort of timeline kind of thing, or just like refuse to use panels in general. Bill Watterson did a lot of that stuff when he was doing like the full page Sunday layouts for Calvin and Hobbes. And I'm wondering, what's your take on
sort of... You don't necessarily have to draw a box around everything.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the artist and the kind of story you're telling, or the kind of comic you're making. It may not even be a story. It may be, you know, a gag comic or something, with one-off jokes or whatever. It really depends. I mean, there's so many different things you can do with it, and so many different layout styles that might make it a better reading experience, or might complement whatever you're doing story wise. So it really depends also on what you plan to do. Is it going to be strictly a web comic where you can take advantage of that infinite canvas, and you can make it scroll down for as long as you like, or you can make it even scroll left and right if you want to drive people insane. or maybe you're making something that's meant to be read mobile, which has been an experience. I've been trying to convert the entire comic to mobile format, which has been an adventure, where I've got a very otherwise horizontal layout. Are you making something that's intended more for print, and you want to just make, or you want to make your life easier when you're translating it from web to print, and you want to make your pages all very consistently, you know, consistent in dimension and
That's true. I didn't actually think about that. The whole transition from online to print. Yeah,
comics has gone from being something that appears in newspaper or comic book form to being something that appears on your phone, that appears on your computer. I mean, it's so you have a lot more things to take into consideration, and in some cases you may want to cover all of those bases. And I want my comic in print. I also want it online, desktop, and also on mobile. And so you may be faced with some difficulty. You may find that, you know, if you want a mobile thing, you don't want to do big, wide, you know, establishing shots. Like I do that a lot with my comic, and they're always a problem to translate those to something you read on your phone in vertical format.
Yeah.
It's always tricky. And so, I mean, yeah, I mean, all these things to take into consideration. It's kind of nuts. It's like, it's almost, almost too many options that you have. And so it makes it harder to figure out how to approach it. But, I think for every artist, it's going to be a different answer, and you got to fiddle around and, you know, look at what comics you like and how they handle this problem, how this, you know, what format is your favorite? What do you envision your comic being? Is it a book? Is it a webcomic? You know, and yeah, it's, I mean, it's, there's just so many factors to take into consideration there.
Yeah.
I think probably Bill Watterson was probably my biggest influence. In the early comics, you can really see that I was doing a very horizontal, like vertically narrow, but wide thing. And that made sense in 2006 because, I mean, we all had these big monitors by then, and monitors were taking on that more, 1080p aspect ratio. Yeah.
Moving away from the square, essentially.
Yeah, moving away from the 5:4 aspect ratio, and so it made sense at that time, but things changed so quickly, and nobody was reading comics on their phone in 2006, but now they are, and so. It's been it's been an interesting thing to try to re-envision how the comic works in that format. I've been doing for Webtoon, which is, I don't know if people are familiar with South Korean web comics are huge over there, and Naver is their biggest publisher there of online or of mobile comics, and they kind of made a American branch of their company, and that's called Webtoon. Competition, I suppose, for things like Tapastic, which I guess is Tapas now. I don't know what their current
food
they keep it's actually I know Tapas is a type of food, but it's also the term for a pretty popular mobile comic platform where artists can go and publish their
Oh, cool.
So, there's so many things to consider. But Lackadaisy, I felt like I think Bill Watterson was my biggest influence in terms of just story layout and or panel layout and even the formulation of a joke. Probably, I grew up on that comic, and so like a lot of comic artists that I know these days, Bill Watterson was a huge factor in that. So I kind of like went with what I knew, and it's kind of like evolved into something different now because I do take advantage of the vertical space, the kind of endless vertical space that you have to kind of like fit a whole chunk of story into that. But when it comes to reformatting it for like book editing it for book layout is I did not do myself any favors in that department. It's like laying out volume 2 for the comic in book form was pretty nightmarish experience, to be honest. It was it was rough, but I ended up with something that I was pretty pleased with overall. So but nice. just a lot of work, so I would caution any webcomic artist to consider that sort of thing, and how much work they're creating for themselves or for some other layout artist that they may have to employ to help them out there. So
speaking of sort of tips for webcomics and webcomic artists, people trying to start out and things like that, Trace asks, you know, any kind of recommendations for anyone wanting to start out like as a webcomic artist?
I mean, social media is maybe your best friend and worst enemy at the same time, because again, there's so many platforms to keep up with to kind of figure out where people are and where your audience is. But I would say kind of figure out if you have an online presence at this time, excuse me, I would, like, for instance, if you have an active Tumblr blog or something, or you're using Instagram or whatever, and you find you like that particular platform, then you might consider using it for your webcomic and tailoring it to that and to an audience that you already have. kind of, not that I think tailoring it to your audience is necessarily the most important thing, but sometimes one of the most important things is to kind of get it out there and get it in front of people's faces. And then you can go from there. But yeah, I think experiment with what you're comfortable with. If you aren't sure, look for comics that you like and see whether they're web comics or print comics or whatever. See how page layouts are handled. What kind of, you know, consider what kind of story you want to tell. If you're just doing gag comics, you can probably do something pretty freeform. You have a lot more, probably a lot more leeway to get away with things that way, because if you're just telling a short, like, you know, four panel little snippet thing, you don't necessarily need panels at all. If you don't want to, you can do something like that on Instagram. But if you're doing something much more elaborate, like a, you know, epic story with lots of lush backgrounds and something that requires people's attention, you might think of doing something with a more fixed, like, website, so that you can put all the accompanying material, like character, like a character page that lists the cast or what have you, or, you know, accompanying artwork, or, you know, little extras that readers might want to know and have something to kind of extra things to invest in or like a little, basically a little resource where they can find out more about what this story is before they decide if they're going to invest, you know, all this time in reading these many, many pages of you know, storytelling. So it's kind of a different game depending on what kind of comic you're doing. But yeah, for the latter, which is basically what I do, I've got, you know, a pretty complex character page that keeps all the characters listed so that people, maybe if someone's like, suddenly introduced to the comic at some random point in the middle, they stumble on it on, you know, social media somewhere, they can go to the website and, you know, put your URL on every one of your pages. they can go to the website and kind of see what this is all about and get the overview and then decide, you know, am I interested in this or not? And kind of gives them that kind of like a map key or a glossary to figure out what, you know, your interest level. Whereas if you have something that's one-off gag comics, those tend to go, I mean, if you do something funny, it's going to go viral pretty quickly. And you can get away without having a, you know, a website that has all this background information, because there's no, like, character, you know, cast of characters to follow or complex, you know, story structure or, you know, lore or what have you to learn about before you or as you read. So yeah, consider what you're doing and look at what other artists are doing and kind of learn from their mistakes and learn from their successes as far as what you want to do. It's really hard to, I apologize for not having more specific advice to give. It's hard because it's such a broad topic. It's, you know,
yeah,
it's you know, can you give me tips on drawing? I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, it's I can, but they're going to be extremely they're going to sound like platitudes and generic, you know, phrases like practice makes perfect, because unless you give me something specific to talk about, it's hard because it's such a huge topic.
No, for sure. But yeah, what you mentioned about like character glossaries and stuff like that, it's a good way for them to sort of determine their own level of involvement in the comic. Like if they want to get more, just give them the resources to be more entrenched in your world, to like understand what it's about, what people's motivations are. Otherwise they can just follow like week to week or look at the pretty pictures or whatever,
right,
just as long as they're involved.
There's different kinds of readers out there. There's I know just from interacting with the people who read or even just look at Lackadaisy but don't read it, I've heard that quite a bit actually, is that I like looking at the art but I don't know what's going on in the story because I don't read the dialogue, but I really like your art, and, you know, the comments like that, it's like, okay, that's fine. If someone's appreciating it, you just kind of, you know, take it for what it's worth and say, okay, if you like the art, if you're here for the art, that's perfectly fine with me. Or if you're just here for the occasional mini comics that I do, like the supplementary stuff, because those tend to be one-off and you don't need to be invested necessarily in the whole story to get what those are about. I mean, that's perfectly fine by me. Some people will get really into the characters and want to know all the details, like what's their blood type, what's their astrological sign, and all this crazy stuff. And And some people will have no interest in that whatsoever, and they'll just want to look at the art, or they'll, or they actually will want to read the story, but they don't care about like the supplementary material. It's a mix, and so you, I mean, kind of go with what you instinctually, I mean, do the thing that you would want to read. Like, what do you love all of that character detail, and you want to have this like supplementary stuff where that you've got some like backstory for the characters, or even like short stories written off on the side about them, and you know, comics. Like short comics that deal with their past life or something like that, or just illustrations and artwork of them that you've done. Some of that stuff can be really engaging for people, and it can really draw them into wanting to know more about the story itself. And so they will start reading the comic on that basis, or they will have read the comic and will go looking for that supplementary stuff just to get more, you know, entrenched in it and involved in it. Because they have a hunger for more knowledge about it. And then you have like probably the bulk of people who read comics are doing it on a much more casual basis, and they just kind of like catch up when they remember to, or you know, they might follow you on social media and only see the things that you know, only if they happen to see your stuff in the feed will they pay any attention to it. But any of that you can get is probably good. So don't get annoyed with people if they say things like, I only look at your comic for the art, because, you know, you've captured their attention in some way. So that's a good sign.
That should be more than enough, right? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. If nobody's reading your comic, well, maybe you have a problem. But if nobody knows what's going on, but that may reflect on your, you know, your writing skills or what have you, or it may just be that, you know, you've attracted a lot of people who really love your art, but aren't that interested in, you know, reading a story. Anyway, it's going to be different for every comic and for every artist producing that comic. What kind of story they want to tell. Probably the best advice I could give is to do what you love. There's this like saying in writing that's like, write what you know, which is great. And you probably, to some extent, should do that. You should know what you're writing about. But for any kind of long-term project, like a comic that's going to require vastly more work than you could even ever prepare for, you might as well really, really love it and really, really indulge in the things that you know, if you have an interest in three or four things and you've had a lifelong interest in them, make your comic about that and really make sure it's something that you have a lasting interest in, because I think that's the biggest area where people fall down is they may start out with this great idea, great premise, and they've got this really polished looking work that they're putting out there, and then like after 5 or 6 pages or 10 or 12 pages they just like taper off and disappear, or they can't keep it up for more than a year because they just don't have an attention span that long, or some other project idea comes along. You gotta if you're really in it for the long haul with telling some long form story, make sure you love it. Alternately, tailor the scope of your comic around your attention span. if you can only maybe manage a year or 2 years of sustained interest in a thing, make it so that it's a story you can tell in that period of time, you know, or do short stories or something. Yeah. You know,
or just do the like the one-offs at a time until you're happy with it.
So there's been obviously there's like you do a lot of cosplay for your characters as well. Like what exactly brought that sort of thing around? Like, I mean, gone to like comic conventions, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, like in a particular sort of outfit from your comic. Like, how exactly does that sort of?
No, I've
wasn't
never
it you?
No,
oh, I've but I've happened. Seen many other people then. In...
I've shared lots of photos of people dressed as characters from the comic, but I've never in my life. I'm a extremely reserved in person. I've been gabbing away here, but I tend to be a very shy, introverted person. I've never gone in costume to anything after age maybe 8, when I wore Halloween costumes at school or something. But that wasn't me. I've encountered many people who have done Rocky and Mordecai and things like that, which has always been like, blows me away, and I don't even know what to say. It's just extremely touching and really makes my week when someone, you know, shows me some cosplay, whether they go full like cat costume sort of thing, mm-hmm. or whether they're just wearing the character's clothes and they're just, you know, they look like a human just dressed as, you know. Someone recently shared that went to a 1920s theme party dressed as Zib from the comic, and it was just the suit and the musical instrument and but it would look great. And yeah, I that stuff has been added icing on the cake of being able to share this work with people. Has been just seeing that kind of like that interest reflected back, and it's been wonderful to see that sort of stuff, but that wasn't me.
Speaking of lackadaisy bleeding into other art forms, any chance of lackadaisy ever moving to any other kind of media? Something longer actually, form, something game like, something.
You do have a game, don't you?
With Tempo. We teamed up and made a card game. Based on his design, it was very similar in shape to the Nordgard card game. And actually, the two games you can, with a few rule modifications, you can combine them together, make right. something really wacky. It's
almost forgot about that. Like I was going to get into that at some point. There you go.
We sold out of them at MFF back in November, and we've been ran into a little bit of a snag producing more of them, some publisher related stuff. I won't get into that, but we've since smoothed that out, and they're going back into production, so we should have some more of them again soon. Looking forward to that, because we were pretty proud of the work we did on that. I think the cards came out nice, and the game design was pretty fun, and
I remember Tempo has been talking about it. It's actually one of the reasons why, not just one of the reasons why we also got in touch with you. It's just that, I mean,
yeah, I think he,
Tempo seems to have like fingers in every single pie that you can find at present in the furry fandom.
Yes, I've noticed that he's the exact opposite of me, very extroverted, outgoing person, and that has served him well, I think, as being both creative and extroverted. I'm actually envious of people who are able to just reach out like that. But yeah, he was the reason we ended up communicating and initially. So yeah.
And I mean, the whole idea of like putting rum runners in the snow actually sounds like a great idea.
I haven't actually played the combined games together yet, mm-hmm. but I look forward to having the opportunity to try that at some convention at some point in the future.
And as far as I remember, there's an online, not an online version, but there's a PC version coming out as well.
That is a work in progress right now, but I think we should. Hopefully, I'm hoping by end of summer we'll have the game back in stock and start making that available again. But we produced a small batch of them, and they sold out pretty immediately. So that was encouraging.
It seems like it is. I mean, like again, like your it's okay.
Use your words.
Trying. I mean, again, like, I just want to sort of move back to your art style just one more time. I mean, like, again, like, with this idea, with like, how many years, and maybe it wasn't even years, but I mean, how long did it take you to sort of perfect this kind of like, style? Like, what exactly, what kind of work needs to be put into that?
Any artist would say that they haven't perfected anything. I think it's a moving goalpost. So whatever you're doing at any given point, someone else may look at it and go, oh, that looks, you know, really polished and good, but the artist internally is like, this is garbage. I hate, you know, I'm in a rut. I need to, you know, and that's pretty much how I feel all the time for speaking personally. So I don't think I've perfected anything. I feel like it's a kind of never-ending chase to just get better at what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But it has been, let's see, doing digital art, I think, since, like I said, I started out with a mouse in Photoshop, and then and that was because my job called for it. I was doing mostly 2D art for them. Initially, the company had these long-running, basically MUDs. They were Gemstone and Dragon Realms, and they needed illustrated art for that, and like little illustrated art packs that accompanied the text. And so I was doing like watercolor and gouache and little paintings like that of you know, fantasy creatures and things. And that's where I started with there. And then the need came up for more digital art, web art, and things like that. And so I it was a necessity that I transitioned to doing digital art. Just the there's no industry at this point in the art world, I think, right now, where you can maybe get away with not having some, some digital prowess. But so yeah, I transitioned over to digital, and that started around 2000, 2001, and so it's been that long since I've been trying to, you know, perfect, as you said, that particular thing. But there's always so many things to learn and so many ways to improve, and you know, there's so many venues on the internet where you can go and find these amazing artists doing crazy things, and then you learn they're like some 15-year-old from Singapore or something, and you just want to die. But you know, but
it's been 18 years.
And yeah, I know. yeah, it's crazy. But
I mean, with sorry, did you want to say something, Scratch?
Something completely off topic, but yeah, go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
I was wondering, like, how's Patreon been treating you?
Good. Patreon was a life-changing experience. So that was really the thing that made it possible for me to leave my job. I had been kind of hemming and hawing about that, not sure if I could somehow build a living, but the micro-donation, you know, paradigm really made it possible. Kickstarter is a different thing, where, you know, if you've got this thing you want to make, and it's more, I couldn't kickstart fund my life so I can make a comic.
Yeah.
That doesn't really, you know, if I was printing a book independently or something, then you could do that. But that, all of that expense goes to printing and shipping and things, and you can't really count on being able to sustain yourself on that. But the Patreon being a long-term sort of thing, they came along initially, and I looked at it and thought maybe I could, you know, supplement my income a little bit with this at some point. But as it kind of gained ground and I saw other artists on there kind of like making a pretty big success of it, I thought, well, you know, I started calculating numbers and came up with the number that I would need to be able to just skirt by and continue paying, you know, bills and pay for groceries and things like that. And I, you know, talked it over with my publisher and kind of worked out a plan for moving ahead. And I saved up as much extra money as I could, just in case, you know, if I launched the Patreon and it was a total failure, then I at least had a cushion I could, you know, fall back on for a little while before I figured out what I was going to even do at that point. Maybe go crawling back to my employer. I didn't mean to quit. But yeah, it was, I don't know, it was... it was a scary time, but it was exhilarating at the same time. To just kind of like, before I couldn't launch the Patreon and then quit my job, because I knew that I would be found out, and that would not have been, I would have ended up losing my job either way. So I had to leave the job and then launch the Patreon and just hope that it worked out, and it did. And it was quite a bit more successful than I had even anticipated. And I think that was just owing to years of having had the comic around and never really ask anybody for any money at all ever. And it was just freely sharing the comic. You know, people seemed to want more of it faster. And while I still feel like I don't produce it fast enough, I'm always in a state of despair over the update rate. I do produce it a lot faster now. And volume 3 has been coming along, and so yeah, it's been hopefully mutually beneficial thing, where people who do follow the comic have gotten more material. There's certainly a lot more extra stuff that I share with patrons now, and things. I do live streams and chat sessions on Discord, and custom drawings for people, and they get to see behind the scenes stuff as well. And, so yeah, it's I mean, the experience with Patreon has been pretty great. There was a little hiccup last December where they were gonna start charging.
All right, that whole chestnut.
Yeah, thankfully they pulled back on that idea and they changed course, But that was scary because me and everybody else was seeing our patron numbers plummet as a result of that. So there was a big outcry. But they have corrected themselves, and they seem to have maybe a better idea of how people use Patreon, and that the small donations really do make up the backbone of the support network that a lot of us have. It's not really like the $20 and $50 donations or $100 donations that people make. It's the multitudes of $1 donations that really, really add up to I can, you know, afford to live and do my work. So hopefully they are aware of that at this point. And they aren't going to do that again. But there's also upcoming things as well that I know Kickstarter has. I think it's called Drip or something, which is not the most appealing name. But I think that's their long-term micro-donation platform that they're coming out with. And there's other things like Ko-fi and stuff like that.
Drip is such a dumb name. You're completely right.
Yeah.
What is something
marketing
like...
questionable, but
why not busk? I mean, that's palatable, at least.
Yeah, like a busker. Yeah, definitely. That'd be more interesting name. Drip just kind of sounds dopey. Like,
yes, exactly.
Like
Kickstarter Drip. But, that's like a category of the ones that never really got off the ground. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, the drips.
Yeah.
The drips and drags.
And it makes it, I don't know. Yeah, when you're dripping content out, it doesn't make it sound very.
Yeah. That's when market
really
research just goes
that?
Too far. Yeah.
Pay for some drips.
Drips and drabs, I guess, maybe. With sort of that kind of question, I mean, obviously you mentioned the idea of streaming artwork and everything like that. Is there a particular platform that people can catch you on, or?
Oh, well, through Patreon, I do the live streams. I do are patron only.
Okay.
So they're usually like small, little intimate, you know, maybe 12 or 13 people usually, sometimes 20 or so, but it depends on the time of day. I do a live stream app, but I do those usually one or two times a month, and the videos. Actually, I've been bad about it lately, not making the videos available because I've been playing music during the streams. I made them, so. I just because the streams go for so long, and I have a hard time working without some kind of music to go by. But
just put it on a separate audio channel.
That's what I have uploaded a few of them to YouTube, and I just mute out the. It's hard to tell what I'm responding to anyway because of the chat that I'm usually answering questions while I work and talking to people, and that you can't see what the chat is actually saying, and so I'm. Kind of speaking into the ether, and it's maybe a little bit weird anyway. So, but if you want to see the artwork, you can find me on YouTube for some examples of what the live streams look like.
YouTube link. So, I just we want to be able to put that into the blurb when it goes up onto YouTube as well.
Yeah, we want to put a link to your live stream.
I guess I better upload some of my more recent. I'll get those uploaded. I save all the live streams to my hard drive anyway. So I'll get those up there on YouTube, and I'll give you a link to that. I think most of my supplementary activity that outside of Patreon, patrons get extra stuff, but I do post a lot on Tumblr as well. I have a Tumblr blog that's pretty active, and I do a lot of Q&A there, and just posting little sketches and previews and mini comics and things like that, just to kind of, it's kind of like a supplementary blog to the comic itself for anybody interested in that.
Oh, cool. Is that I know that we've got a couple of links here from you.
I think I gave you
your lackadaisy at tumblr.com.
You can just go to the website, and there's a link right to it there anyway. So
I will post
lackadaisy.com, and that'll get you to any of the places that I post art or you know, the Patreon and things like that.
I mean, like, it. Weird question, actually. Probably not very weird, but I mean, like, again, you've been doing this for as long as most people have been born at times. does it ever get sawn off?
Does it get what?
Sawn off, like, sort of like
drawn out.
Drawn out.
I certainly think as an artist, you can wear out your welcome. I hope I haven't done that, but I mean, I'm certainly cognizant of the fact that it could happen at some point and people will just go away.
No, we're not, I'm not necessarily talking about people feel, how people feel about your art. I'm talking about you and...
Oh, me and my interest in it?
Yeah.
I have not lost interest in it. I tend to have a pretty long attention span when it comes to doing projects like this, but there's so many aspects to it and so many things I can focus on. I think that keeps me preoccupied. I still very much want to tell the story of the characters, and I've been wanting to do that for years, and I've been like consistently anxious to do it, even though it's slow going, you know, to get from point A to point B with the story, because I have to draw everything that happens as well as write it. if you ever want to know what making comics is like, it's like writing a book and also drawing everything that happens. And it's frustrating that I can't move faster. But as far as getting bored with it, that's not been an issue. Because, I mean, even if I'm frustrated with a particular chapter of the comic that I'm working on and I feel like I'm, you know, experiencing artist block there, or I don't want to work on that chapter because I don't like it or something like that. Or I want to rework it because it's just, you know, nothing is, you know, the catalyzing properly. I have other things I can do that are related to it. So much of the comic is also about, Lackadaisy is also very much about the artwork that I do that goes with it, and the mini comics and all this other, you know, extraneous stuff that is really complementary material, but I think adds a lot of maybe some richness to the whole thing. A lot of the side comics deal with the characters in the past, and so it can maybe give readers a little bit of insight into, you know, what those characters are, what their lives were like before, and there's like bits of history in there, and sometimes just one-off jokes, and sometimes it's just like a totally silly, you know, thing that clearly didn't happen, is a non-canon thing, but I still use the characters to tell the joke, and so yeah, I mean, there's just so many different things, so many different aspects to it. Just the comic creation itself, there's the writing and the page layout and the art itself, it's hard to get, and the research, it's hard to get bored. There's so many aspects to it. At least that's personally for me. I know that, like I was saying before, I think a lot of the place where a lot of artists fall down is they have a grand vision, but they don't have the attention span to focus on it as much as it needs, or they realize it's way more work than they were prepared for, and they maybe kind of wander off and do something else, or sometimes they just, you know, you get a job in the art industry, you're maybe doing something for fun, and you get employed and you find it very hard to do art all day at work and then come home and do more of it. So yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why things end like that, but so far I'm still pretty obsessed with it, so I'll just keep working on it. I mean, I really want to finish it at this point. I'd be remiss, I think, to be just like, yeah, I'm bored with this now, I'm done. So, but I'm fortunate that I really truly don't feel that way. Hope that shows in the work I produce that I'm, you know, still really putting my heart into it.
It definitely looks like it.
Well, good. That's good.
So,
No, we're good.
Trace has another question, and it's actually one that I've been wanting to ask for a while now. Which of your characters do you enjoy most, or do you most enjoy drawing, and whose story would you like to explore more?
It really depends on my mood on any given day of the week. Sometimes one character is just more relatable than the others for whatever reason. I think probably... top three favorites that cycle around are Victor, Rocky, and maybe a tie between Mordecai and Zib. any character whose headspace I can get into easily at any given point, I tend to dwell on them. But it's hard to say I have a favorite exactly. I mean, sometimes probably my favorite to draw is Rocky pretty consistently, because he's so demonstrative and expressive. He's got such a thespian streak, theatrical streak. it's fun to kind of indulge in his over-the-top mannerisms. I can get away with more with his character than I can with a lot of the others, and it still seems like, yeah, that's definitely characteristic of Rocky. In terms of writing dialogue, Mordecai and Zib are probably the most fun for me because they're both pretty dry and sarcastic, and that's feels natural for me to write because I'm in functioning, I'm probably of a similar mindset. Not that I have any inclination toward murder or bootlegging or anything personally, but it's just, you know, the characters are relatable on one level or another, and I just kind of hinge on that. I think Ivy can be very fun too. She's kind of like, you know, everything I wish I could have been when I was a young girl, outgoing and stylish, and, you know, just knows what's hip and what's not, and she knows what's happening, and she's also got a little bit of that, I don't know, maybe a little bit of like that adventure seeking slightly self-destructive streak. And I was such a obedient child. I was so tethered to the rules and so afraid to step out of line. And so, yeah, a lot of the characters I think I like most are sometimes the ones that relate, that I can relate to easily, and sometimes more the ones that are just so different from me that it's like a escape to be able to write them and draw them
Tapping into that unexplored part of the psyche.
Yeah, exactly. It's a chance to, it's like acting. I think I made a little joke picture at one point where I described the writing process for characters as acting for shut-ins. It's like, I'm never going to go out on a stage and perform in this manner. I can barely manage to do public speaking at all without having a meltdown. But the enjoyment is largely in the just acting through drawing and writing. And I think you have to have a little bit of an actor mentality to do that, maybe. Anyway, in terms of background, yeah, a lot of the characters I like to weave pretty detailed backgrounds for them, but I think I think of it more as a tool for writing them in the present to understand where they're coming from. It kind of helps to make them more specific and less of a trope. Although there are certainly elements of trope, and then I don't know. I feel like mixing. What's the term I'm looking for? Archetypal character themes with other things that are more specific, or with subversive things that maybe make a character look like one archetype, but they're really not that, can be a powerful thing to kind of, the archetype makes the character kind of instantly recognizable in a way, and maybe likable on some basic level, but then to add that extra specificity rounds them out as a full character instead of just a one-dimensional, mythological, or basic human storytelling theme. So yeah, character backstories are important in that way, I think. And there are some that I've spoken about before, wanting to do short one-off side comics if I can ever find time for it. certainly Rocky is one of them that I want to do. He has had a lot of misadventures. There's a little hints of it here and there in the comic where he writes to Freckle, or you can see the letters he wrote to Freckle when he was not living in proximity to him, and the array of different jobs he had and lost very quickly, the adventures he had in between. Certainly Mordecai is one I'd like to explore a little bit as well. He had a whole life, whole different life before he was doing, he was still very shady sort of life, but yeah. It was, didn't start out that way clearly, but he kind of fell in at a young age and has had the events leading up to him working at Lackadaisy for Atlas, I think are would be good storytelling material maybe too. It pretty much any of Zib and Mitzi is another one I think I would have liked to or would like to eventually explore. They were traveling band basically, and with the other band members, and I think that's also something that would be fun to tell more about. but
yeah,
we'll see if I have the opportunity to do that. I have actually spoke to Tempo. I don't want to like put it out there as something that's definitely going to happen, but I have spoken to him about maybe doing some short story writing along those lines, you know, because it's probable that drawing out all of those backstories in addition to the comic, which requires, you know, intense focus on the art, is maybe not a possibility, but maybe written form is a possibility. And so it's something I've spoken to him a little bit about, and maybe that's something I'll pursue in the future if I can find a way to fund that or to collaborate with somebody to kind of help me speed that along at a reasonable pace. I think maybe some of the readers would have fun exploring the character backgrounds a bit more.
Yeah, no, definitely. Okay, we've gone
we've burnt through our time,
That was amazing. Thanks. Thank you very much. I'd like to just also say that, like, when we mentioned that you were going to be on our podcast, there are a couple of people who would like to also just, like, say that you've really inspired them to be artists as well. I know, for instance, Badge, my partner, has actually mentioned this on several occasions leading up to today, like, you know, saying things like, you know, you're one of the people that he wants to aspire towards being, and I'm sure that there are many other people who are listening who would like to express the same thing. And again, like, your artwork has been an inspiration to many. I'm more than not even assuming that. For me, obviously, I couldn't draw a stick figure without it making, like, I don't know, bendies in random places. So, I mean, again, your work is absolutely admirable. We really appreciate having you on here. And it's great to hear you sort of talk as passionately about the work that you do, and we find that to be absolutely amazing.
Oh, well, thank you. It's exceedingly kind of you to say, and I was happy to join you here. You guys are excellent conversation, and I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and to answer some questions. Thanks to, is it Trace and, was it Kit?
Trace and Kit, yeah.
Thank you for the questions, and I'm extremely touched to hear if I've inspired anyone in any minor way at all. I don't know that I could have asked for anything more gratifying as an artist than to be able to, you know, pass the torch along a little bit. Because there certainly have been artists in my life who really steered, you know, how I ended up here, and they forever have my gratitude, and the best thing I could hope to do is to pass that along a little bit. So thank you.
All right. Trace and Kit also say, you know, again, they something sentiment.
Cool. Well done.
Reiterate the sentiments, I think. Yeah. I don't know.
You'll pass on the sentiment.
Pass on their own sentiment of also saying that they're, like, they also think that your art is very inspiring. It's absolutely beautiful stuff. We're looking out for more, and I'm definitely, like, it's been around since 2006, and it was around about then that I actually, like, sort of stumbled upon it. I think it was like 10 or 11 pages in, and I was just sitting there going, like, does it update?
Well, anybody who's, you know, even followed it in a very casual way for that long, I have to thank them for their patience and for bearing with me, or just having the stamina to pay attention for any prolonged period of time. I really appreciate that, because I know it's update rate is never ideal, but if anybody, you know, is still putting up with me, then thank you. I have a sustained interest in this thing, but I can't ask, you know, that level of interest from anybody else, obviously. And so any kind of, you know, someone says I've been reading it since the beginning, or, you know, going back to a few years, and they have my deep, deep gratitude. So thank you.
I mean, it's our deep gratitude to you, honestly. Like, your content has inspired many, and it's beautiful stuff. And
well, it's
just
hoping
that
it's
going.
There were points in my life when I didn't think I was even employable as an artist. I didn't think I could make it as an artist. My family, they were very well-meaning in their discouragement of me being an artist, but they did discourage me. And I'm glad I didn't listen. I'm glad I, because it's been, I honestly can't imagine doing anything else. And it's been made so rewarding by the people who read it and provide feedback and ask questions and say things like, you know, you give me some inspiration to do the same thing. And that's, that's wonderful. Thank you.
Right. Well, thank you for joining us. We really do appreciate you sort of taking out a little bit of time to sort of speak to us and speak about your work and everything like that. It's really, really good. Loved this interview.
Oh, yes, I know, for sure. I personally...
One
last thing we usually end up doing is if there's anything mm-hmm. you want to plug, like perhaps the next volume coming out at any given point in time, you have the floor to push any of your commercial agenda, I suppose.
Card Game should be along in a couple months. Should have that back in stock. Mm-hmm. That'll be at 4DE.com. which is mm-hmm. my publisher. You can find books there as well. You can find Lackadaisy Volume 1, at least on Amazon, usually. And lackadaisy.com is my website, and that's basically mm-hmm. a hub to anything Lackadaisy-related you might find. There's a pretty wonderful Discord community that's been growing over the past year, started last year about this time, and I think we've got about 2,000 members right now. So it's become pretty active, and if you want to just come by and chat with people who like art and history and comics and games and cats and also dogs, then by all means, come on by. Discord, again, is you can get to that from the Lackadaisy website. So
okay,
I'll throw that out there.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Tracy. We really, really did enjoy this podcast.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. And enjoy the rest. Well, I guess it's Sunday night there for you, huh?
Yeah.
So enjoy the evening and have an excellent week.
Yeah. Same to you. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday, Tracy.
All right. Bye-bye.
Cheers, Tracy. Thanks a lot.
See you guys.
Take care.
See you guys next week.
Cheers, guys.
Bye.